you would, if you want to turn to Exodus around chapter 12, we're going to be jumping around the Exodus story that which is a part of our Torah portion today. And like I said, it sort of blends in together. But back when I was a real young child, and maybe it's the same thing with you guys, I had a Bible that opened up, and when you open it up on the front page, it had a place for you to put your name. It had a place for you to put your name, and then it had a place for you to put the name of the person who gave you the Bible, and then it had a place for all of these dates. Or maybe it wasn't on the front, the same page, but on the back page. And you had your birth date, and you had your anniversary date, and you had a number of dates. But of course, one of the dates that was on there was your baptism date. And I always remember that, because I look back, when I think about that, I look back at my baptism. And I'm sure I am totally different from everybody else in this room. Because when I got baptized, and I'm going to tell you just quickly what happened when I got baptized. I moved down here in the East Texas area in 1978, and I met Angie, my wife. And we dated, and we decided we were going to get married. And so I thought, man, I've been a part of this church here for a long time, and part of the thing is that you don't become unequally yoked, so I had to get married. I mean, I had to get baptized. I knew I had to get baptized. And so I went, and I counseled with this guy, this minister, and it didn't turn out too good, all right? And he gave me a whole bunch of things to read, a whole bunch of books to read and all that, and said, when you get all this stuff done, come back and visit me. Well, I didn't come back and visit him. I just dropped it. And so I was going along, and Angie and I had set the date and all of this. And at that time, we had a new pastor come into our area. And this new pastor came up to me one day and says, don't you think it's about time you get baptized? And I said to myself, yeah, probably is. And so I counseled with a guy, and I only had one little short counseling session, and he said, okay, let's do it. So a few weeks later, or actually I guess the next week, I got baptized in this little pool up here in Big Sandy. And so the thing about it, though, was that was something I did in order to satisfy the halakha, you might say, in our area. I had to get baptized in order to marry this girl, okay? That was just the way it was done. But as time went on, I would hear people talk about their baptism date. And they would say, well, I was baptized on this day, or I was baptized this. And for us, we never talked about joining the church. We always talked about our baptism date. That was the critical day in our life. And so, and that's not a bad thing. That's good. Thing is, I didn't remember my baptism date. Because for me, it really wasn't that big of a deal. It was what I had to do in order to get married. And so the date went by, but I always felt bad about this, not knowing my baptism date. And so I set my mind that I was going to someday call the organization and find out when I was baptized. But of course, I'd feel so embarrassed to do it that I never did do it. So to this day, I still don't remember the day that I got baptized. Well, the reason I say that is that baptism is an important thing. It really is, and it shouldn't be taken as lightly as what I took it. It's more than just an event, and as we've come to see, it's a showing of an interchange of your heart. It's an outward show of the interchange of your heart, and quite frankly, at that time, I didn't have the interchange in heart. Maybe I was justified in that because I was brought up in this way, and I never had the big change in life that many people experience, and so I just didn't have any big feeling, I just felt like, well, this is the thing to do. Go get baptized so you can get buried. And so that's what happened to me. Well, there's a number of approaches we could take in studying baptism, but for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to leave aside many of the common things that we discuss when we talk baptism, and I'm going to focus in on simply the Exodus story. Because as we go through these salvation cycles that we're going through, and at this point, you remember we've talked about bondage, we've talked about redemption, then we talked last time about salvation, we've talked about our covenant relationship. Well, at this point, I think in the walk of the children of Israel, they came upon a point where they were baptized. And we need to see exactly what that meant in regards to the baptism of the children of Israel. So to start, we're going to lay down a few terms in here and find out a little bit about this word baptism that we may not have known. The first place in the New Testament we see the word baptism is in Matthew 3, and this is when Yeshua is coming to John the Baptist to get baptized. And that's Matthew chapter 3, and if you were to read that text there, it talks about, it just goes into the story of baptism. It just starts talking about it as if it already had been. The word baptism right there is from the Greek word baptismo. And if Greek didn't have all those glyphs that are so hard to write, I would write it down. But just the word baptize comes from baptizo. I can write that. Baptizo. And that's the word that you get, or the different forms of that word is where we get the concept of baptismo or baptizing. And it's Strong's number 907, if you're interested, 907. Now, the interesting thing about the word baptize is that baptize is a Greek word. Baptize is not an English word. And so when you go into the Bible and when you read the New Testament text, what you're reading for the most part are translations of Greek words. You're reading translations of Greek words. But when it comes to the word baptize, what you're reading is a transliteration of a Greek word. And we know, does everybody understand the difference between a translation and a transliteration? A transliteration, if there's a Greek word, Java, okay? I'll just say Java. To transliterate that word Java would be Java. Okay? But to translate that word would probably be coffee. Okay? Because we understand Java, coffee, we have that association. So a transliteration is simply taking the phonetic sound of one language and putting English letters to that phonetic sound. So when you get baptized, baptize is a Greek word that is transliterated into English. And so since it's a transliteration, it doesn't come with definition.
Can I stop you for a minute? Greg, your glasses are in here, dear.
That's what he was looking for before that.
We found they were over here. He was sitting over there. He was over there.
Right
there. All right. You were sitting right there.
Where are my glasses?
Okay. Okay, so we see what you're saying. We don't have a word in English that directly translates the Greek word baptizo. That's what I'm saying. And so what we have to do then is start looking at the usage of the word, or go back to how the Greeks use the word baptizo in order to figure out what it's all about. And if you were to go into the Strong's, or you go into most of your concordances and your Greek dictionaries, you would find that the word simply means to dip. It simply means to dip. It has no spiritual connotation at all. No spiritual connotation at all.
To immerse,
to dip or to immerse. If you dip something in your, if you dip a cookie in your coffee, you're immersing it into the coffee, right? Okay. Actually, the word, to show how carnal, not carnal, it's not a good word, but to show how secular the word is, you can go back to some of the Greek writings of the day, and you will find that ships that hit rocks and sank were baptized. That's how secular the word really is. It has no spiritual connotation to it at all. Now, you can take, though, the word baptize, and you can find out the Hebrew concept of the word by going through the Septuagint, just as we've talked about before. Real quickly, what you do is you take and find out the Greek, how the glyphs all are together in the Greek, and you find a Hebrew word to match it. And, of course, the best way to do that is to take and look up a word that you think it means and see if they match. And if you were to look up the Hebrew word or the English word dip in the Old Testament and look at the Hebrew letters, you're going to find, or the Greek letters in the Septuagint that was translated from, you're going to find the same word, baptizo. Baptizo. So that's how we can find out what the word actually means. So you go back into Tanakh, and you'll find that baptizo in Hebrew is Tavol. Right?
What on earth is that letter? I've never seen that letter before in my life.
It's Tavol. The Greek word or the Hebrew word is Tavol. Now, the actual meaning of the word in the word pictures is sort of the concept of the head of the house surrounds. Remember, the tet is a snake and surrounds, and the bait and llama is sort of the head type thing. So it's sort of the head surrounds the house is basically what it is. But for our purposes, what we would want to do is find out how the word is used. And we find a number of places where it's used. And I'm going to go to the second place, though, to illustrate its use. The second place we see the word Tavol used, and we'll go to the first one here in a few minutes. The second place is in Exodus 12:22. And who has that open? Does anybody have that?
22.
Exodus 12:22. Somebody just read Exodus 12:22. Okay, so you see it says, you shall dip the hyssop in the blood. The Hebrew word for dip there is Tavol.
What's the Strong's number?
Tavol. Strong's number 2881. So, if you were to go to the Septuagint and you were to read in the Septuagint the Greek letters, you would find that the word there is baptizo. So what it was saying is that you shall take a bunch of hyssop, baptize it in the blood that is in the basin. That's actually what it says in the Septuagint, if you were able to read the Septuagint in the Greek. If you read it in the Hebrew or in the English, it's going to say dip. Okay, but if you read it in the Greek, it would say the same other. Another place that we see the word Tavol is in 2 Kings 5:14. 2 Kings 5:14, I'll just read that real quick. It says, this is speaking of Naaman, who was told by Elisha, you know, how to cure your leprosy. And he says, then he went down, speaking of Naaman, and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh again became like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. So here we find Naaman dipping Tavol in the Jordan River. And the Hebrew or the Greek word that was used in the Septuagint to translate this was baptizo. Baptizo. So Naaman was baptized in the Jordan River. In both cases, the Exodus case and the 2 Kings 5 verse 14 case, the word baptizo is used in is used in the Septuagint. So, again, in the case of the Passover, we'll find that the hyssop itself was baptized in the blood. So does it sort of, we're starting to see then a little bit of difference in the word baptism and the understanding of it. So if the word itself, baptize, has no spiritual significance, then what's so important about baptism? That's one of the things. Huh?
He did it.
Well, that's what we need to find out. What's so important about baptism? And there is importance to baptism. So again, let's go back to the very first place the word baptize is used in the New Testament. And we find that Yeshua is going down to the Jordan River. Now, and going to where John is. Now, John was baptizing in the area of Judea. Yeshua lived in the Galilee. So if John was baptizing in the area of Judea, the closest place for John to baptize would be someplace around Jericho. Because you go due east from Jerusalem and you come pretty much to Jericho. But that spot is about 50 miles south of Capernaum, where Yeshua lived. And so, unless Yeshua went there during a festival, which I don't think he did, then he made a pretty long trip just to go down there and be baptized there where John was baptizing. Now, it says that the Pharisees were coming there to be baptized, and that John's baptism was a baptism of repentance. And so I would assume that this was during the period of Teshuvah, 40 days prior to the Day of Atonement, that this took place. But that's not relevant really to the story. The point we want to see here is that John enters into a discussion on baptism, or not but John, Matthew, he enters into a discussion on baptism without ever explaining what baptism is. He just assumes the reader knows what baptism is. And since we are the readers, then how are we going to know what baptism is all about if the New Testament, or if John, or if Matthew in this case, does not give us a definition? Well, the only way we can find out is, again, to go back to the Tanakh and see what the Tanakh has to say about it. We cannot derive and establish our understanding of baptism simply from what the New Testament says. Because if we don't have this concept of what is in the Old Testament about baptism, then we're going to have erroneous views of what baptism is in the New Testament. So it's imperative for us to go back there and look and see what it says. And so, if you listen to Brad Scott says that the very best thing to do in order to find the meaning of a word is to go back to the very first place it's used. And the very first place you see the word tovah, which we know is equal to baptism, is in Genesis 37, verses 31 and 32. And this is the story of Joseph being sold to the Midianites. Genesis 37, verse 31 says, "So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, 'We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?'" I mean, like, you know, whose is this? We've never seen this before. Well, obviously they were being deceptive, right? So in order to take and substantiate their story that they had all agreed upon, that Joseph was killed and all they happened to do was come upon this tunic that was laying out there in the middle of the wilderness, and they just picked this thing up and said, "Hey Dad, we found this. Whose is this? Could this be Joseph's?" You know? In order to substantiate it, what did they do? They dipped the tunic in blood. They baptized the tunic in the blood. Now, what was the purpose of the baptism of the tunic in the blood? Did the baptism really have anything to do with the story? Well, not necessarily. Because they were trying to establish evidence of what they were doing, or what they wanted Joseph to Jacob to believe. So their dipping had nothing to do with their deception, other than it helped to substantiate the deception. Right? Am I making myself clear? Well, they dipped it. Okay, they could have also poured blood on it, right? It didn't really matter how they got the blood on it. They just got blood on it. And so the point being is this, is that the process of getting the blood on was not important. It was the result of what came about. And the result was that it convinced Jacob that his son was dead. Right? Okay, so the baptism itself, the form that it took was not as important as the result that came about. And the brothers, they were able to achieve the result because this was a convincing enough thing to prove to their father that Joseph was dead. Okay. So that's the first place we see the word baptism in the Bible. The taval, okay? That's the very first place we see it. And it was used to convince someone of something that had happened. It was used to convince someone of something that had happened. Now, the next place we find it is in the Septuagint. I mean, in the Septuagint again is Exodus 12, verse 22, and we read this before. The hyssop was dipped in the blood that's in the basin. And then there's an interesting thing that happens here, and I have to credit this to Brad because Brad actually does a really good job of teaching this, and I'm just going to brush over it real quick. You probably want to read his whole thing on baptism sometime. But we've talked before during Passover, and if you've ever kept Passover with us, we always talk about the blood being put on the doorpost and on the lintel of the home. But we also make a point that the basin that's talked about is the threshold of the house, or the threshold of the door. So, and as is customary in Middle Eastern sacrificial process, they kill the animal at the door. Whenever a person brought a sacrifice to the tabernacle, they were to kill the sacrifice at the door of the tabernacle. So these Passover lambs were killed at the door, and so therefore there was blood in the bottom there on the threshold of the door, and then they took the hyssop that they baptized into this blood that was down here in the ground. And actually the word taval actually indicates that you're pressing the whatever you're doing down into whatever you're doing. So they actually pressed this hyssop down into the blood, and then they would spread it up around the door. Well, Brad makes this point, and that is that in biblical concepts, blood outside of the body indicates death. Because where is blood supposed to be? It's supposed to be inside the body. So blood outside of the body indicates death. So taking blood and putting it on the doorpost of the house would indicate death. Okay? And now, because they were completely surrounded by blood, the door was completely surrounded by blood, if a person went in that house through the blood, in Middle Eastern understanding, that person is dead. All right? So you've got a whole household of people inside here who are all basically dead because they went through the blood. So the death angel or the destroyer, when it comes along and it wants to kill something, would it stop at a house where everybody's already dead? No. And so what the dipping had to do in this case was to help make a way for the destroyer to not take you and kill you because you are basically already dead, right? And as we read some of the writings of Paul, what does Paul talk about that we are to be? We're supposed to be dead. So the baptism sort of helps us to become dead. And then the destroyer is not going to want to kill something that's already dead. How many of us go out and look for a dead deer out in the woods to shoot? We just don't do it, do we? All right. So I thought that was a very good point. Huh?
Mom would be the only kind I would
Yeah.
Not online.
So, as we continue on with the Exodus story, we can see this concept of baptism, Tavol, being associated with death. And the death then is there to help do what? Help to preserve your life. So we go on down and we read about the story that we read about in the parashah today, which is just very coincidental. And I think it's really worked out good. And we see that the children of Israel walked through the sea, and the sea was water on both sides. And lo and behold, the Apostle Paul likens what happened there to what? To baptism. And if we read in 1 Corinthians 10, it says, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." They're all baptized. 1 Corinthians 10, 1. So Paul understood this, the Exodus story, to be the baptism of the children of Israel. And there's a lot of concepts in Hebrew thought that are tied to the concept of baptism, such as born again, becoming a new man, a new creation. All of these are Hebraic concepts that go along with the concept of baptism. Because in the Jewish understanding, when you become a proselyte to Judaism, part of the proselyte's process is to be baptized. Because for them, that indicates that you have died to your old ways, and now you're being resurrected as an Israelite. I mean, as a Jew, in this case. Which, in their minds, was an Israelite also, which is right. I mean, I shouldn't have said it, but that's all right. You took and died as a non-Jew or not as a Gentile, and you became a son of Abraham. That's what baptism was understood as in the first century. But there's some interesting things that happened as the children of Israel went through the sea. Now, we talked about some new ideas this afternoon, and that's all good. But one of the things that Paul says, and I think is quite interesting, is this. He says that all Israel was baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. In the cloud and in the sea. Now, we have, based probably on our movie history, watching the Exodus, you know, or the Ten Commandments, we have this concept that the Israelites were running through the sea and it was just beautiful day outside, and the sun was shining, and all of this stuff. And in fact, I got a picture on this PowerPoint that showed just a nice, bright day. And even though there's this light up here, supposedly producing light, there was all kinds of light, and it was nice and bright, and all of that stuff. But there's a problem with that, and that is that when Paul says they were baptized in the cloud and in the sea, that has significance. You know, we just don't waste words in the Bible. And so, how many of you have been in a cloud? Well, all of us, okay? Because anytime we're in the fog, there's a fog, we are in a cloud. And if you've got a dense fog, and you're driving, and say you're in a hurry, it can be quite tense, can it? Because in a dense fog, you know, sometimes you but see 10, 15 feet ahead of you. And if you ever notice when it talks about a cloud in relation to God, it always calls it a thick cloud. A thick cloud. So if a regular cloud that we see could cause it to be where you can't see very far, then a thick cloud would probably get it to where you can't see hardly anywhere. Now, I've been in clouds, and I fly sometimes, I don't fly much anymore. But when I used to fly, sometimes we would get in clouds that were so thick we couldn't see the end of our wing, which is only 10 feet away. And so when you're in a situation like that, it is very disconcerting. You get very confused as to where you are. And so when Paul says they were baptized in the cloud and in the sea, and we realize that here we are, we got water on both sides, and say, and I, what I'm seeing is that this cloud has come down on top of the children of Israel. They may not be able to see the person next to them. And when they're walking through here, it could be so thick that they don't know where they're at. They don't know if they've got turned around or not. They don't know if they're going the right direction. But all they know is that maybe an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours ago, they entered in to a sea with water on both sides, and now they don't know where they're at. And we don't know if it was daylight in that cloud. I mean, you get into some of these clouds when you're flying along, and it gets so dark in these clouds, you don't even know that if it's daylight or not sometimes. So you have this thick cloud, you have this situation where they are helpless. And they may not know if they're going to come out of this. I certainly don't believe that their situation was where they saw the sky and they saw the sun out or anything like that. I'm going to have to take it after this. So very easy for them to get turned around. So they were surrounded by the water on both sides. They were surrounded by the cloud above. And of course, what is a cloud? Cloud is water. So they had water basically all around them. And if the cloud was so thick that they couldn't even see their feet, which I could imagine that could be, they may think, you know, all they could know of is that they were surrounded by water. So the Israelites, when you think about what happened to them, they went into this sea very fearful. They had made a choice. You know, they were there on the shore, on the eastern shore. Yeah, western shore. They're on the western shore of the Red Sea. And they saw the Egyptians coming after them. And they had a choice to make. They could either go into that sea or they could turn around. And if they turned around, what would happen? Now, we would assume that they may have been killed, but they could have also, by surrendering to the Egyptians, then they would have just simply become slaves again to the Egyptians, and thus they would have sentenced their children to becoming slaves and their grandchildren to becoming slaves. And so they had a choice to make. Are we going to go into the sea where we may die in the sea, or are we going to go back and submit to the Egyptians and become slaves? Well, it appears that they all made the decision that they were going to go into the sea. And so they went into the sea basically trusting that what Moses was telling them to do was correct. They went through the sea. You might say that while they were in the sea, they were in the valley of death because they were down below the sides of the water, and I would submit that they probably didn't know if they were going to come out of this thing alive or not. But as they continued on, they emerged down the other end. And when they emerged on the other end, what were they? They were free people. They were free men. All it took for them to do was to go get submerged in that water. Be completely surrounded by water. So, within 1 week, the word Tovah had changed their life twice. Their baptism had changed their life twice. First, in taking that blood and pushing it down in the blood, or that hyssop, pushing it down in the blood, and the second time, going into that Red Sea, into the sea. And then, as they came out, like I said, they came out as free men. So thus far, we see that baptism can symbolize life. It can symbolize death. And in the case of the Israelites coming out on the other side, their status actually changed from being slaves on one side to being free people on the other side. Now, as we remember back in Exodus 6, God said that He was going to take Israel as His bride. So, in order to be taken as the bride, certain things had to happen. And I think God followed a Hebrew Jewish practice in everything that he did pretty closely. Obviously, not everything worked out perfectly, but he followed it pretty closely. For one thing, as far as and part of a Jewish wedding, when a man and a woman have decided that they're going to get married, and basically it's because their parents decided they're going to get married, they would have a ketubah. That would be a set of laws that we all understand as, in our case, would probably have been the Ten Commandments. And even though this doesn't fit necessarily the perfect order, I do believe that the Israelites were starting to be given some of God's laws as they walked. In fact, we do know in this passage we read today that after they crossed the Red Sea, God didn't waste any time starting to teach them about his way. The bride price was the next thing that was done, and this is where the groom was to give the father a price in order to basically, some money to basically purchase the bride. And in this case, God says that he gave the firstborn of Egypt for Israel. And there's a couple of places actually indicate that the bride price that was paid was the death of the Egyptian firstborn. And then the next part in the Egyptian or the Jewish wedding is a ritual immersion. And so I believe what happened here is God was going through and doing this ritual immersion with the Israelites at this point. And what the ritual immersion does is this. After the bride price is paid, the Jewish woman who's going to get married basically no longer belongs to her husband. Or, I'm sorry, does no longer belong to her father. She is now a free woman, and she is awaiting the betrothal of her husband. She's awaiting her husband to take and actually go through the rest of the betrothal procedure. And so here for a brief moment, she is a free woman, totally free. But she doesn't want to remain free. She wants to be betrothed. But because she's had this change of status in her life, she goes through a ritual immersion. And this ritual immersion is what shows and indicates that she now is a free woman. As we said earlier, through the examples we've got, the ritual immersion was not the important thing. It was the results of the ritual immersion that's important. And for this woman, she went through this ritual immersion, but what people saw then was a woman who was now free. Free, basically, to marry. And, of course, she is now going to be betrothed to her husband. This is the state that we find Israel in. So how do we apply all this to the salvation cycles that we've been talking about? Quite simply, it's this. To be a follower of the God of Israel, you must let your old self die and be raised up a new man. It's very simple. We have to die first and be raised as a new man. And what better way to illustrate that than with water? I mean, why does God do things the way he does? He's got his reasons. Sometimes we don't understand. But water immersion is a very interesting concept that we really don't know that much about. And what's marvelous about God is that he creates things to do things, and we can't figure them out, but yet God has it all planned out. And water is one of those interesting things that we don't really understand. Science today still doesn't really understand water. I'm going to tell you some things about water. First off, we know that water is one of the very simplest of molecules. It's, like we say, we know H2O, two oxygen and one hydrogen molecules put together. What we don't understand is how that can do anything, because the molecular structure of water should not be able to perform all the things that it does. Water reacts differently than practically every other liquid in known to man. For instance, water expands on both ends of the heat spectrum. When it gets hot, it expands. When it gets cold, it expands. Every other thing in the universe, when it gets hot, it expands. When it gets cold, it contracts. And every other liquid does. Water is unique in this area. Water is also the only liquid that evaporates at both ends of the spectrum. When it gets hot, it evaporates. When it gets cold, it evaporates. Now, how many of you knew that water evaporated when it got cold? Okay. Right, they do. Okay, that's called a sublimation. It's called sublimation. We learned about that. I learned about that when I was learning to instrument fly, because what you're taught is when you're flying, if you fly through clouds and it's below freezing, your wings can ice up, and that's not a good thing. And so what they tell you to do is not to descend unless you know it's warm below you. They tell you not to descend. What's the best thing to do is to climb higher if you can climb. And the reason why is because the colder it gets, the faster the ice will melt off your wings. So that's just the way it is. We don't understand it, but that's just the way it is. The colder it gets, the quicker ice melts. And so ice will take and evaporate off your wing. It actually doesn't melt. It just simply evaporates. It just simply evaporates. We know also that water is essential to life. And scientists, whenever they're looking for life on another planet, they're always trying to prove that we weren't created, you know, and there's other life out there. What do they look for? They look for water because they know that water is essential to life. But we also know that water can kill, right? Because if you're underneath water very long, you're going to die. And then another, what's that?
Can you drink too much water, you can die.
Can you? I never heard that, but is that true? Another thing that is interesting about water is that, remember, God used water to take and kill all mankind except for Adam and his family, right? Noah and his family, right. God used water to kill all but Noah and his family. But then what did God do to show that he wouldn't do it again? He put a rainbow up. Well, what is a rainbow? Rainbow is caused from water. Right. Rainbow is light passing through the water. Now, something interesting about that is that when you have light passing through water, it breaks up to where you actually see all the different aspects of light. Right. You see all of this. You see all these, you know, you got one beam going in there and you're going to go through a prism like this. And all of a sudden you see all these different aspects of light by going through the water. Right. And so we have a definition of light in the Bible. And what is that definition? What is the light? Yeah. Yeshua is the light. But also King David says, your law is a light unto my life and a lamp unto my feet. So if we can equate the light going in, and we can equate, instead of a prism here, baptism, what do we see coming out? We come in with the light, Torah, and then mix that with what we receive from baptism. Now we have an understanding of God that we didn't have before. So, why did Israel need to be baptized? Well, I would suggest the reason Israel needed to be baptized is because they went in not understanding their God. They went into the sea not understanding God. They went in with a slave mentality, and we know that as slaves, you cannot truly think for yourself. As a slave, you truly cannot, what am I trying to say? You truly cannot take care of yourself. Most people, when they were slaves, were taken care of. In fact, the Israelites in Egypt, they apparently were taken care of. They had good food and all of that stuff, which is smart for a slave owner to feed your slaves because you get more work out of them. And so they were taken care of. They went in with a slave mentality, but God could not work with people with a slave mentality because God needs people that can think for themselves and will think for themselves. And so they went in as slaves, they came out as free men. And now God has a bride, or he has a people that he can work with. So this is, I believe, the cycle that we have to go through as we're going through these cycles of salvation. This is the point, baptism, where we actually show God that we are a new people. We're a people that want to walk in his ways. We may be thinking it, we may be contemplating it, but that going through the water is what actually, might say, seals the deal and brings us to a point that we can actually move forward in our life as a follower of the God of Israel.